Good afternoon. This is Representative Mahmoud Nur. I call this meeting of the Committee of Workforce and Business Development, Finance and Policy to order. Members, please mute your mic. This remote hearing is conducted pursuant to Rule 10.01. This remote hearing can be viewed online through the House television webcast. With that, I wanted to ask the committee legislative assistants to call the roll.
Noor.
Present.
Jay Chong.
Present.
Hamilton.
Present.
Baker.
Here.
Dabney.
Present.
Frankie.
Present.
Greenman.
Present.
Haley.
Present.
Juergens.
Present.
Cagle.
Present.
Katizawatun. Katizawatun. Olson.
Present.
Tujong. Tujong. Katizawatun. Katizawatun.
I just admitted her to the meeting. Let's give her a minute to get signed in and let her.
Tujong. And then they're both in the room. Okay. Katizawatun.
Present.
Tujong.
Present.
Chair, we have quorum.
Thank you, Jason. There's a quorum present. I will entertain a motion to approve the minutes of January 20th.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
I'll go with two members approving. Chair Dabney moves the approval of the minutes for January 20. Any discussions? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? See none. The minutes, the motion to approve the minutes for January 20 have been approved. Having said that, we are really fortunate today to have two individuals who really understand the demographic and the economy for the state. We do have two guests, Dr. Kalambukiris and Dr. Bra. So I just wanted to welcome them to the committee and Travis, I don't know if you're going to be sharing the presentation for the first presenter. We will have a hearing on many aspects of the economy for the state and looking deeply into the shifting demographic, the changes that we foresee, and how all this really relates to work that we do every single day. So we will start with Dr. Kalambukiris, please welcome to the Workforce and Business Development Committee, and you may proceed and introduce yourself.
Great, thank you. I'll make sure I've got my, hopefully you can see my slides. Starts with Minnesota's Economic Outlook. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm grateful to be here today to talk about Minnesota's economy, and particularly some labor market effects since the start of the economic downturn. For the record, I am Laura Kalambukiris, Minnesota State Economist. I'm going to start with the most recent US economic outlook. So for those of you who, for just an update, we presented our November forecast on the first week of December, and we're now working on the February forecast. And so some of the forecast information I'll present to you is relative to November, so that you can see a comparison of what we've seen since the November forecast. So we'll start with the U.S. economic outlook, because Minnesota's economy is closely tied to the U.S. outlook. And then I'm going to move to some of the labor market indicators for Minnesota, and also throughout talk about some of the things that were really unique and surprising and extraordinary about the economic downturn that began with the pandemic at the beginning of last year. So the first slide I'm showing you is the U.S. economic outlook. In each case, the height of the bar is the annual growth in real GDP. We've shown you in the dark bars the history, and then the January 21 outlook by our economic or macro forecasting consulting firm. So my office does not do a forecast of the U.S. economy. We do a forecast of the Minnesota's economy. We purchase a forecast from a consulting firm. That firm is called IHS. So we're measuring real GDP here and showing annual growth rates. If you look in the left-hand side of the chart, that series of dark bars, we don't always show the history, but I did it this time in order to give you an idea of what happened in the last recession. So the recession of 08-09, you can see real GDP becoming negative. So growth is below the horizon. And real GDP declined by, real GDP growth became negative, not GDP became negative. The GDP declined by 0.1% in 2008 and 2.5% in 2009. And then what follows is 10 years of growth. So that was the longest economic expansion in U.S. history. And that ended in February with a contraction or a decline in GDP. Then if you look at the right-hand side of the graph, you can see the forecast comparison where the dark bars are the January outlook for IHS. So they produce an outlook every month. And the gray bars show the November outlook, which is the one that governed our, or that informed our Minnesota economic and revenue forecast. Since November, the US outlook has improved, where for this year, for 21, in November, IHS was expecting 3% growth, and they're now expecting 4% growth. And then they have higher growth next year as well, and then growth comes back down after that. So they described this, before I get to the forecast comparison, they described this recovery, this pattern here, as a bounce and fade, meaning we declined, we bounced up, and then growth declines. And I'll show you that more clearly in another slide. But regarding the forecast comparison, there were several things that changed between their November outlook and their January. But the most important one in determining how this forecast, the difference between the 3.1 and 4.0 for this year, is that in November, they had assumed no further federal pandemic relief payments than what had already been passed. And since then, we had the $900 billion pandemic relief bill package passed at the end of 2020. And so that 3.1 to the 4.0, the main reason for that jump is because of those federal payments. They also incorporated the sort of surge in COVID cases that also occurred toward the end of the year, but the positive impact of the COVID relief payments offset that. This slide is also real GDP, but this is showing levels or dollar amounts of GDP. And in the last one, I was showing you growth rates. So the line here is the level of real GDP. And I just show you this to show what that recovery looks like, that bounce and fade recovery, where we look at 2020, you can see two quarters of negative growth or decline, where the line goes down. We had a record decline, quarterly decline in the second quarter, and then a record bounce, a record growth, quarterly growth in the third quarter, and then growth continues after that. And you can compare the picture, what this looks like to, again, I showed the history so that you can see what happened in the last recession, where the duration was longer, the decline was not as sharp, and the duration was longer. What else to tell you about this? Some of the assumptions here is, so IHS is saying that growth will return this year, positive growth. It will be weaker in the second half than in the first half. And then the third quarter of 21, the economy starts to transition from recovery to expansion. And the main assumption that's happening there in the middle of the year that makes a difference here is that IHS is assuming that by the middle of the year, we'll have widespread availability of an effective vaccine to the general population. So the path of the economy depends critically on the path of the pandemic, the rollout of vaccines, and the ability of governments to lift restrictions. So that they expect a significant portion of the population to be vaccinated during the summer so that we can transition to more of an expansion mode of the economy later in the year. IHS expects the real GDP to reach the pre-pandemic peak later this year and then reach full employment in early 2022. So that path, the US recovery path, depends critically on the pandemic itself. So on what happens with the disease and with caseloads. At the moment, IHS is assuming, or with their January outlook, they're assuming that the 7-day average of daily infections peaks this month and then recedes, and that governments then can, later in the year, as I said, they can lift restrictions and we become get closer to growth or increase economic growth. All of those pandemic-related impacts also exacerbate or amplify what are normal economic uncertainties or normal economic risks. So at what point are consumers and businesses confident about safety and feel that they can get back to normal activity? What businesses are going to survive through the winter to make it to this point in the summer when things potentially can be lifted? And then IHS assumed, as I said, the $900 billion package that had already passed, but in their January outlook, they're not assuming any additional federal stimulus. So changes in these assumptions will change the outlook. We'll have one more macro forecast that we'll look at before we complete our February forecast for Minnesota. So now I'm going to add in some information about Minnesota. And this chart shows the headline unemployment rate, so the overall unemployment rate for the United States and for Minnesota. The gray line is for the U.S. and the blue line is for Minnesota. The vertical gray bars are for the U.S. Recessions. So the white space between the bars is the U.S. recovery and expansion periods. Again, we show the history so you can see what happened in the prior recession and the prior expansion. So in February, prior to the pandemic taking hold and restrictions being put on place, Minnesota's unemployment rate had been driven to a very low level, 2 point something. I don't have the number there. And there was a pretty tight gap between the U.S. and Minnesota's unemployment rate. Then the pandemic became a factor, restrictions were put in place, and Minnesota's unemployment rate spiked to 7.7%. So you can see that it's a higher, with the blue line, you can see that that peak in the spring is higher than the unemployment rate we reached in the previous recession. The United States unemployment rate had reached a peak of close to 15, so it was 14.7%. Since then, we had a couple of things happen. So this, since the spring, we had the original set of pandemic relief payments go out to individuals and businesses, and we had eventually some restrictions lifted from the original restrictions that were put in place in the spring. And those things have driven down the unemployment rate to where Minnesota now has an unemployment rate of 4.4%, and the U.S. unemployment rate is 6.7%. Again, this is the headline unemployment rate for overall across the economy. It does not tell the entire story. And one of the points that it doesn't tell you is that several of the last few months of decline in the unemployment rate have been because people have left the labor force in Minnesota and not because people who were looking for work got work. And so we now are in a situation where 102,000 Minnesotans have left the labor force since February. And that's not reflected in the unemployment rate. The unemployment rate can continue to fall even as people are leaving. But it does leave us with 131,000 Minnesotans unemployed compared to a much lower level in February. Another view of the labor market is to look not at the unemployment rate, but at employment. So the line on this graph is measuring total employment, which is the total number of jobs in Minnesota that have somebody doing the job. You can only count a job when somebody's in it. And the historical line is this fairly steady upward sloping line, which shows that during that historically long U.S. economic expansion, Minnesota pretty steadily added jobs. So we added 337 jobs during that expansion from July 09 to February of 20. The slope of the line gets a little shallower at the top, the curve starts to bend, and that means that our employment growth was slowing as we were getting to the end of the economic expansion. And that's largely because Minnesota's labor supply was tight. The aging of the workforce means that we had fewer people available to work, and that tightened restricted our ability to add jobs. But by February of 2020, we had reached about 3 million employed people. Then the pandemic hits, restrictions are put in place, and we lost 388,000 jobs in March and April. Since then, on net, we have regained 140,000 jobs. That was a sharp bounce, again, a bounce up, and then a fade. So we had a sharp bounce when restrictions were originally lifted. Then the last data point of employment, the reference date for that data was during the last pause of additional restrictions that the governor had put in place in November and December. And so we lost jobs in those months. So our gap, so our COVID gap right now, the number of jobs we have that are fewer than what we had in February is 248,000. So we had this very high spike in the unemployment rate. We've lost this large number of jobs. In our forecast, then we have to forecast employment and total wages. And so that's what I'm showing in this chart. So the measure here is total wage and salary income in Minnesota. That means you take all of the payrolls of all of the employers of the entire state and you add those all together. And then the height of the bar shows the annual growth in that value. So it's not wages per worker, it's total wages and salaries. It means it can grow if more people are working, or it can grow if the same number of people are working and they're making more money per hour. But as you can see, again, we show you the history of wage and salary growth in the state on the left-hand side of the chart in the dark bars, and then the striped bars show our forecast. So if you look at the history, you can see that during the last recession, total wage and salary income declined by 4.8%. It almost always grows unless we're in a recession. And then we had, again, those 10 years of economic expansion. We know that wage and salary income fell in total last year, and our forecast says that it fell 1.4% last year. And then we have, because the U.S. is recovering, Minnesota is going to recover, and we have a recovery of wage and salary income growth going forward. But that's a pretty striking difference, the minus 4.8% versus the 1.4% that we have for this expansion, or I'm sorry, for this recession. And that became an important observation and question for us is how can we have a relatively small decline in wage and salary income when the unemployment rate had spiked at such a high level. Granted, it's not a small number to the people who are experiencing it, but in aggregate, it was smaller than what we had seen in the previous recession. So let me start to explain that. And the reason for that difference is because unemployment was not evenly distributed across the economy in Minnesota, in the US either. There were differential impacts across industries, across occupations, and across individuals. And that affected that growth rate in wage and salary income. So as is probably not a surprise to anyone, it is clear now that the leisure and hospitality sector in Minnesota was hit the hardest with regard to loss of jobs. The chart here shows the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 industry sectors in Minnesota. So it's employment in industry sectors. The six that were the hardest hit by the pandemic downturn of last year. And we chose the ones that initially lost more than 20,000 jobs. So that's what we mean by hardest hit, initially lost more than 20,000 jobs. And the difference in the bar is the number of jobs, the change in the number of jobs from the beginning of last year to, for the dark bars, it's to May. So that shows that plunge in the spring. And then for the light bars, it's the difference from the beginning of the year, or I think February, actually, from February to December. So the difference for each industry, the difference between the blue and the gray bar is that partial recovery that they've had since the pandemic started. And the percentages, the size of the bar is the number of jobs lost, and then we put the percentage change in there, too, for reference. But through December, there were 123,400 fewer jobs in the leisure and hospitality industry. And for all, that's a 44% drop. So that's a very significant drop in the number of jobs. And all other sectors combined lost 113,000 jobs. So the leisure and hospitality industry was hit much harder than other sectors. And you can see in the difference between the blue and the gray bar for the blue and the gray bars for leisure and hospitality, they haven't recovered as much as the other sectors have. There was a story I think it was in the Star Tribune this morning about healthcare service jobs having been lost in Minnesota. Those are incorporated in the second set of bars. So that sector is called educational and healthcare services. It includes healthcare services, which is the largest by number of jobs, the largest employer in Minnesota. It also includes private educational services. So that educational component is not K through 12 and the public university. It's for-profit colleges and private education. But for Minnesota, the bulk of that is healthcare services. And so you can see the decline since from February to December, which would be the gray bar there. We're showing a loss of about 27,000 jobs in that sector. The difference between that number and the number that was reported in the newspaper today is because we've got both education and healthcare services in there, and because the timing is different. But roughly that 10,000 job loss for healthcare services is similar to what we have. All right. So we're trying to explain this uneven impact of unemployment in Minnesota. So one thing we did was we looked at initial claims for unemployment insurance benefits from the beginning of the pandemic to this one is from this chart looks at from March to November. So the bulk of the job losses and the bulk of the unemployment claims that were made and with the unemployment claim data, we don't know what industry people were in, but we know what occupation they were in. Those are two different things. And we determined the median hourly wage per occupation, and then ranked them from lowest to highest. And what we've learned from this is that 34% of initial unemployment insurance claimants from March through November were in occupations with median hourly wages in the lowest quintile, so the lowest wage workers. And then if you add the two lowest together, the two lowest wage quintiles account for 57% of total claimants. So this starts to explain why wage growth, total wage growth, or the total wage decline the size of the total wage decline was not as large as it would have been had unemployment been more evenly distributed across occupations. It's because lowest wage workers were the most affected by unemployment. This graph is another aspect of that. This is US data, and it looks at change in employment by income level. I'm sorry that the lines don't look differentiated with the dashes and the dots, but what it is it looks at the percent change relative to January 2020 of unemployment by income percentile. So the high income workers are the top line, the middle income workers are the middle line, and the low income workers are the low line. And what it shows is that for low income workers, employment is still now as of December is still well below where it had been at the beginning of the year. Middle-income workers have nearly recovered, so their line is almost up to the horizon. And high-income workers, actually, for part of the year, were actually ahead of where they were relative to the prior year, relative to the beginning of the year. And so the duration of unemployment has also been has mostly impacted lower-income workers. So one more aspect of the pandemic that, or not just the pandemic, but the economic downturn that I want to emphasize for you that shows how things were different from expected, and that it has to do with consumer spending. So one of the main reasons why the U.S. economic outlook improved over the summer and the fall was because of the pandemic relief payments that the federal government made available to so many consumers and businesses. And that meant that consumer spending was higher that in 2020 than had been expected at the beginning of 2020. So in April and May and June, we weren't expecting consumer spending to recover as much as it did. But another thing that happened is that consumers shifted the way they spend. So this chart shows consumer spending on services. So these are some of the kinds of services, it's not all services, but it's the kinds of services that require face-to-face interaction. So some of the ones that were most affected by restrictions and by safety concerns. And what you can see is that what we're showing here is IHS's forecast for spending on these kinds of services. And we're showing their February of 20 forecast, so before the pandemic was incorporated into the economic data. So the dashed line is the February outlook. The blue dashed line, the gray dashed line is their November outlook. That's the one that informed our last forecast. And then the solid line is the January outlook. And what you can see is that in February, consumer spending on services was expected to just steadily grow over the forecast horizon. But indeed, in the spring, when restrictions went into place, they plummeted and have not yet caught up to where they would have been had the February outlook been correct and had the pandemic not happened. So that's intuitive. That's what you would expect to see. But the one that's counterintuitive is the same graph, but this one's for durable goods. So these are for things like furniture, electronics, the kinds of things that consumers buy that last a long time. The dashed line here again shows February. You can see again, expecting a steady rise of consumer spending on these goods. The gray dashed line is the November outlook, and then the solid line is the January outlook. What happened is that consumer spending on durable goods actually diverted from the February forecast by going higher than what was expected in the February forecast in the spring, and it has remained above what the February forecast was. So what does this mean? It means this is another one of the surprising things that affected both our economic outlook and our revenue outlook, which is that consumer spending overall was higher than what had been anticipated, but also businesses figured out how to serve customers safely, and so people were able to keep spending their money. The people who did retain their jobs and retain their incomes found different ways to spend. They shifted their spending. So some of the surprising things about this downturn were how severe it was in the beginning, how sharply it declined, the GDP declined in the beginning, the potential shortness of it. I mean, it may be over now. We won't know the length of a recession is not, we don't find out until after the fact when the end date was, but it was a sharp and maybe hopefully relatively short recession, that the impact of unemployment was uneven across industries and it was uneven across wage levels, and that consumer spending shifted in ways that that kind of softened the blow for sales tax receipts. So this is one point that I failed to make about this particular chart about durable goods, is that these are taxable. So a lot of the services that aren't taxable, we shifted away from and started spending on goods that are taxable. That ends my prepared remarks. I don't know if you want me to take questions now or wait until Dr. Brower has completed her presentation.
Thank you, Dr. Kalambukidis. I know there are a few individuals who raised their hand, so I want to give them the opportunity to ask questions. I'm hoping that you'll stay with us and to answer any questions later. Chair Dabney.
Thank you, Chair Noor. Doctor, you sparked my interest at the very beginning of your slides, looking at the projections forward in terms of GDP growth. You probably do not remember, in fact, I hope you're not spending brain space remembering the Ways and Means Committee from like February of 2020, where I raised the concern about the impact of the Trump tax reduction bill, the Jobs Training and Something Act. I forget the acronym.
Tax Cuts and Jobs Act.
That's it. Thank you. And you assured me, A, that there was a demonstrated increase in GDP following that. And some of my friends across the aisle assured me there was no concerns to be had about the deficit. Mm. Now, of course, there's all sorts of concerns being expressed about the deficit. But I'm wondering, given the conversation you had at the beginning of our session today, and IHS factoring in whether or whether there not there would be further federal stimulus, if economists have been able to identify an impact on the GDP from the stimulus efforts that have gone on. And if so, how much and how does that compare to the previous tax bill that we discussed?
Dr. Kalambukidis?
Mr. Chair, Representative, let me just restate this a little bit. So I think you're asking, there are two things that happen when the government spends like this, puts stimulus money into the economy. One is they may stimulate the economy and increase consumer spending and consequently increase GDP. Consumer spending is 2/3 of GDP. So if you can boost that, you can boost GDP growth. And then the other thing that happens is because all of this spending is being financed by the deficit, it's not being financed by tax increases, then it increases the deficit and it increases U.S. debt. Is that, are those the juxtaposition there?
And Mr. Chair, Doctor, yes.
So the question, and it's a great question, and it's something that honestly, we are at a crossroads here in macroeconomics about just how concerned about the debt to GDP ratio we should be. Now, in the past, it seemed like a very important concern, and it has been built into macro forecasts going forward that a high debt to GDP ratio leads to slower growth. And that's partly why, if you go further forward out into IHS's outlook, growth doesn't stay at 3.9. Growth gets down to 2.5. Some of that is because of drag from the debt. But it is clear that the stimulus that was done during the summer that went to businesses and consumers significantly helped the economy, the U.S. economy grow. And there is a growing, I won't say consensus, but there are a lot of economists who believe that we need more of that in order to keep the economy growing, and that the potential in the future of a drag on GDP from the high debt is not as important as right now getting money into the economy. So IHS is, in the near term, they're very clearly saying that this stimulus that has already been passed and any additional stimulus would help grow the economy. And that's not as big a concern as what they've also incorporated into the longer term forecast, which is a high debt to GDP ratio can be a drag.
Chair Dabney?
No, Mr. Chair, Doctor, thank you very much for that.
And the next person is Representative Kotizo Otun.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for being with us, Dr. Kalamakaitis. I'm curious, a few weeks back, we had seen a jobs report federally about the number of jobs lost in December and how all of them were women. And I'm hopeful that you could just maybe expand upon that a little bit for us here in Minnesota. Of course, if there were any jobs lost here in Minnesota in December and those were being counted in the federal report, that means it's certainly a disproportionate impact on our female population here in Minnesota. And I'm hoping that you can just give us a little bit more insight on that.
Dr. Kalamakaitis.
Chair, thank you, representative members of the committee. My recollection of that U.S. report is that on net, those jobs lost were women. I don't remember the details of that report, but let me say what I know about Minnesota. And so I've brought you back to the employment chart. The last two data points on this chart, I don't know if you can see my arrow, but the last two data points here are November and December. So our employment declined on net in November and December. But the data have not caught up to the data on that distinction of jobs lost by women and men. So by race, by gender, we don't have, the data have not caught up with us yet. So I can't make a statement like that about Minnesota jobs lost. And, you know, the unemployment rate that we do have unemployment rate data by sex, and both the male and female unemployment rates have increased. But at the same time, the female labor force participation rate has increased year over year. What that means, so as the labor force participation rate has gone up year over year, but the unemployment rate has also gone up year over year, what it means is that the logic there is that women may have entered the labor force and not found jobs. I also don't have data on, you know, the previous slide where I have the number of people who have left the workforce. I don't have that broken down by sex either. So I don't know if Dr. Bauer may have something more to say about the impact of the differential impact of the pandemic across other groups of people, but regarding employment, the data haven't caught up with us yet.
Representative Cotuzo-Tun, any follow-up?
Thank you. I'm not sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm not sure what the timeline may look for some of that data, Dr. Kalamakaitis, but if you could maybe bring it back to us here on the committee throughout this session when it's available, that would be really interesting.
Sure.
Thank you so much.
Representative Cagle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Dr. Kalamakaitis, I was just wondering what the breakdown of wages are. So what is considered low income, medium income, and high income? If you could just kind of break it down into numbers for me.
Good question. Oh, I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Chair.
Representative, I don't know the answer to that. I don't have it with me, but we can get back to you on that. But for both of these slides, I think the data might be in our forecast book, but we'll get back to you on that.
Thank you.
Thank you. The next person I see before we go to Dr. Barr is Representative Haley.
Thank you, Chair Noor. And this may have been answered, Doctor, that you don't have the information, but I'll ask it anyway, just by curiosity around the 102,000 people that have left the labor force since February. And I was wondering if we understood if those were people that don't have the skills for the current jobs that are open and therefore, or if it was, parents that at some point then decided to pull out of the workforce in order to help their children with stay-at-home learning. So again, you may have answered that with the other representative's question, but I was curious because I think that would help us understand, you know, where do we put our funding and our efforts towards getting people, you know, back in the workforce.
Dr. Kalamakaitis?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, I do not have the answer for that. Again, Dr. Bauer may have other data sets that that provide information that would be useful to you there. Your intuition, you know, we have similar intuition about why people may have left the labor force this year, given all the confluence of things that happen in terms of children doing remote learning and family members being sick and all of those kinds of things. And another thing I would add, and again, I don't know the answer yet, but is that the downturn in the pandemic may have led people to retire sooner than they might have otherwise, people who had that option available to them. And so leaving the labor force is not necessarily all working age people, that some of it could have been people who are of retirement age accelerating that decision.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Kalambakidis. I know I have other questions, but I will defer to the end. I wanted to welcome Dr. Barr to introduce herself and start the presentation.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. I'll just take a moment to share my screen here. I just feel like I'm showing my age when it takes me too long to do this. One moment, please. And are you able to see my first slide?
Yes, Dr. Barr.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Susan Brower. I'm the state demographer and I work in the Department of Administration. I've been asked to talk to you today about Minnesota's workforce demographics and about the impacts of COVID-19 on Minnesota's workers and by extension on Minnesota's families and communities. And for years, I've been reporting on one of the biggest impacts of related to workforce of demographics is the slow growing workforce that's impacted Minnesota employers by causing a shortage of workers needed to fill the jobs that Minnesota have. This trend was particularly acute in some areas of greater Minnesota. It was and it is driven by long-term demographic trends that limit the number of people, the supply of people available to work. And that slow-growing workforce is still a reality, of course, but because our underlying demographics are still there. But of course, disruptions due to the coronavirus now are taking center stage for good reason. They're now our immediate concern. And so I'll split my remarks, my presentation today, both into kind of giving a background on our workforce and who makes up Minnesota's workforce, and then also looking to what the impacts of coronavirus have been on Minnesota workers and on our communities. So with that, as a piece of background, Minnesota's demographics have been shaped by four decades by the presence of Minnesota baby boomers in the workforce. The large baby boom generation, you can see here, baby boomers in 2019 were ages 55 to 73. Many of them have already left the workforce. And that's something that we don't hear all the time, or it doesn't register all the time, I think, because we've been hearing for so many decades that they're about to leave the workforce. We're really getting to the point where it's actually happening. And when we look at the numbers now, you can see those blue bars on the left of the graph show the age by age, which proportion are people outside of the workforce. The green bars are showing you that same age group who is in the workforce. I want to point out that this first set of data that I'm sharing with you are from the calendar year 2019. And so some of the questions that were just asked can't be answered by these data. This is more of a background, and then we'll move into some of the changes that we know have happened, some of which we know some of the answers to, and others we just don't have the data to answer. So I want to note here, just looking at who our workers are today, that the largest cohort of workers right now are in their 30s. That's relatively new as the baby boomers were part of the workforce. So the emerging prominence of workers who are earlier in their careers, those who are part of the millennial generation, has a number of implications for the makeup of our current workforce. Younger workers are more likely to be parents. They're more likely to be part of a Black, Indigenous, people of color, or BIPOC community. They have lower earnings on average compared to older workers who are later in their careers. Now we have a generation, Generation X, that is moving into the later career stages as the baby boomers retire. And so here's where we are today. I think we've gotten more accustomed to think about the makeup of the workforce, including baby boomers. That's still the case, but they are quickly retiring, and we're beginning to see that in our numbers. I mentioned that this is from 2019, this is when we had full employment in Minnesota, so that was the context here. Those who were in the labor force really were not in the labor, there was a very small margin of those who wanted to be in the labor force or wanted to be employed, but were not employed. And so this is kind of at the height of employment that we're looking at here in this graph. In 2019, we had that very tight labor market. It was constrained by the availability of workers, and a very large share of our state was in the labor force overall. Compared to Minnesota, 69% was in the workforce. Compared to the U.S., that was 63.6%. So a much higher share was in the workforce than for the U.S. overall. So as I mentioned at the outset, Minnesota's labor force growth has declined in recent years. That doesn't mean that the number of workers has declined, but it just has not grown as quickly as in the past. But the modest growth that has happened in the last 9 years, shown on this graph here, is attributable entirely to growth of populations of color or BIPOC workers. The number of white workers between 2010 and 2019 actually declined, and the number of BIPOC workers increased by about 600,000. So again, the trend of increasing diversity among our workforce that we've been hearing about for a very long time is indeed in full swing and taking hold. Before the impact of COVID hit, that was the case and continues today. This diversification of our workplace took place as younger, more diverse workers aged into the working years, and as older baby boomers retired, largely white baby boomers retired from the workplace. The diversification of the state's workforce is not exclusive to the Twin Cities or to any metropolitan area. Really across the state, including many rural communities, have seen more diverse workforce as the older generation retire. For the state overall, there's been a similar growth among Black, Latino, and Asian workers, with Black workers slightly outpacing the growth of Latino and Asian workers in the past decade, so that now, as of 2019, Minnesota's workforce includes about 181,000 Black workers, 161,000 Latino workers, 158,000 Asian workers, and 23,000 Indigenous workers. In terms of educational attainment, Minnesota has a slightly higher average, higher than average compared to the U.S., of educational attainment, with about 42% of Minnesota's workers with a bachelor's degree or higher, compared to 38% nationally. Just 5% of Minnesota workers have less than high school education, compared to about 8% nationally. And in past recessions, workers with higher levels of educational attainment have been more insulated from job losses. There's some evidence to suggest that with the current economic situation due to COVID, that's the case as well. We saw that in terms of earnings anyway, with the numbers that Dr. Columbakita shared with us. But we know that those with higher levels of education in this pandemic have transitioned, have been able to make a smoother transition to telework than some of the jobs with lower levels of education that required face-to-face contact in order to be able to do the job. Again, numbers from before the pandemic, but to give us some background on who our workers are and the makeup of our workforce, and also to show that some of the cultural communities that we have in Minnesota are more vulnerable to job losses. We're looking here at the 17 largest cultural groups within Minnesota and the percent that have less than a high school degree of the working age population. Minnesota's largest cultural groups, besides white non-Hispanic, are Black, African-American, U.S.-born African-Americans. And among that group, about 15% have less than high school education. This is of the workers. 40% of Mexican workers, another large group, 37% of Somali workers, and about 25% of Hmong workers have less than high school education. And so that speaks to differences in terms of the jobs that people hold, but also to their vulnerability to downturns generally and to COVID-related downturns specifically. Before I shift to talk about some of the data on the impacts of COVID, I just want to point out that in talking about the composition of Minnesota's workforce, a large share of Minnesota's workers are parents. We saw that a large share of workers are now in their 30s. And we have estimated that about 820,000 workers, or about 25%, about a quarter of the workforce, are parents. So a large share, and this is just of children who might require childcare, so children ages 0 to 12. That's about, as I said, about a quarter of Minnesota's workforce, and about 120,000 of those are single parents, which just increases kind of the demands on time and the ability to work versus the need to care for younger children. So this is important in terms of workforce to think generally about childcare as a prerequisite to labor force participation and to kind of the affordability of childcare, but also during the time of COVID, as we have considered kind of competing demands on workers' time, the need for parents to care for children when school has been out of session or has been remote, to balance both the demands of work and child care, impacts a larger share of our a large share of our workforce. So I'm going to turn now and look at some of the data that show us how the workforce has been impacted, how our communities have been impacted by COVID-19. The Census Bureau has a survey that began in June of 2020, looking back a couple of months, and it goes through December 2020, and it's called the Household Pulse, and it asks specifically about how different employment, education, and health, a number of different indicators changed as a result of COVID. And so this is a somewhat experimental survey, but it really is the best community level data that we have outside of administrative data on how large the scale of the impact has been for Minnesotans. These data come from a survey, so there's margins of error associated with them. So we really want to look at these generally as giving us a general look, a general insight into how COVID, how many people have been impacted by COVID and in what ways. And what these survey data suggest is that about 47% of households in Minnesota have reported some loss of income due to COVID-19. This is a household level survey, so they're asking, of the person who filled out the survey, was there any adult in the household that had a loss of employment income? This was any time over the period since March 13th, the reference period. So it's not reflecting a point in time that 47% of households now have lost are losing income at the time of the survey, but relative over that entire period, has there been any income loss? So I think that's an important distinction to make when looking at this graph. However, it does give us a sense that the impact of income loss has been disproportionate across different types of workers. And you can see kind of what we might have expected in terms of the impact on educational attainment, workers with different levels of educational attainment, workers from different race and ethnic groups, and then those who are parents versus who are not parents, all have slightly different impacts of employment income since March 13th. If we look at both the short and long-term consequences of the COVID-19 on employment, now we're looking, rather than looking at has there been any change in employment income, now we're looking just in the past week as of December 20th, if you're not working, why is it that you're not working? And so I think this answers some of the questions that were raised earlier, that some of these issues are related to the care of children. They're related to the availability or ability of people to work if they're home sick themselves or if they're caring for someone who's sick. That's a relatively smaller proportion than those who are laid off because their employer didn't have the work for them. And so what we're seeing from these survey, the Household Pulse survey, is that a larger share of those not working in December, again, this is just in the reference week in December, were not working because they were laid off from their jobs or because they were temporarily not working as their employer had less work for them. Hopefully that means that the path back to employment is quicker. If there's still those connections between employers and employees, that people as the businesses recover, will be able to be brought back quickly into work. So that's, I think, a hopeful sign when I look at those layoffs or a reduction that there may still be a connection there between between the employer and between the employee, rather than some of these other categories where the employer went out of business entirely, is a relatively smaller share as of December. I just want to share briefly some of the types of indicators that are in the survey, and I invite you to explore them in more detail, but just to give you a sense of how Minnesota families and communities have been impacted, there's still a high proportion of folks who report that foreclosure or eviction is somewhat likely or very likely in the next 2 months. So still a precarious spot for a lot of folks in Minnesota and across the US. We're very close, we're slightly higher than the average there. Again, since this is a survey, I wouldn't make too much of the few points difference, but just to say that this really is something that has impacted many households in Minnesota, that even as of December, we're seeing that is an important impact of COVID. Similarly, if we look at food insecurity, about 1 in 10 Minnesota households, the adults report not having enough to eat in the last week. So we're still, even as of December, experiencing many of the impacts of COVID, although, of course, some of these conditions existed before COVID as well. I want to point to two perhaps longer term impacts of COVID as it relates to workforce. And one is just how plans have changed, post-secondary plans or college plans have changed as a result of COVID. About 80% of households that had a post-secondary student said that there was some type of significant change in the plans in the last year. And we look and can see what some of those plans are. Some may have less impact long-term in terms of workforce. If classes are in a different format, that may not have such a big impact if the quality was still there and if people are still learning the same types of skills that they otherwise would be, but doing so remotely, that may not be such a big long-term impact. But if we look at the reduction, there's a proportion with a reduction in the classes that were taken, or they've opted out of classes altogether, or they've taken different classes, it has the potential in what may again be a tight labor market in the future, we hope, will potentially cause another wrinkle here. And so I just want to keep that on your radar as another kind of pathway that COVID could impact the workforce in the coming years. And another kind of similar impact, although it doesn't have a clear directionality to it, a large share of Minnesota workers have shifted to telework during this pandemic. You can see here that a slightly higher percent, but it's very close to the national average, have shifted to telework. We know that workers with more education are more likely to be in industries where they can do this kind of shift, can go ahead and work remotely. That's looking across the averages. And so this may have a longer term impact on our patterns of work in the future, not only patterns of work for different industries, but also geographically, where are people able to do work? Where will employers find it palatable for workers to do their work? And then how is broadband availability also a part of this new kind of telework frontier moving forward? And so with that, that's the end of my prepared remarks. I'm happy to take questions, Mr. Chair.
Thank you so much, Dr. Barra, for the insight into the demographic shifts and changes. So with that, I just wanted to start with Vice Chair Zhong, Jay Zhong.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Brower, can you share with us the financial impact of the pandemic in this economy? And then you were talking, when you were breaking down the terms of population for unemployment, can you also share what were those stats within the states?
Rupert Zhong, I think your volume was a little bit low. If you can repeat a little bit, that'll be great. Your sound wasn't great.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can hear you.
Okay. Is it better?
Okay. Better.
Okay, so Ms. Brown, can you share with us what the financial impact of the Black Indigenous People of Color communities in our Minnesota economy? And then when you were speaking on the unemployment in Minnesota, and you were breaking it down by ethnicity, can you share with us also what were these jobs that are within these communities?
Dr. Barra.
Mr. Chair, so representative and members, so I think if I'm hearing correctly, you're asking for the financial impact in the aggregate and whole for all BIPOC workers. And I know there have been some studies on looking at immigrant communities. I'm not sure that I have seen any specifically on BIPOC workers, but I'm happy to take a look and provide that for you if that's something that's been done. The other question was, remind me, I'm sorry.
Jay Jong, Representative Jong.
When you had that slide on unemployment, and you were breaking it down by race and ethnicity, and you showing the percentage of the different communities were impacted, can you share with us what were these stats?
Mr. Chair, thank you. Representative, yes, I don't have those in front of me, but I know that's something that is something that I can absolutely get for you.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mine was going to be a question, but I guess it'll kind of be more of a comment as we went through the slides, was around what are the levers that can easily be flipped to kind of come out of COVID. And that was very clear in your slide around the job vacancies. You know, hopefully if businesses stay open, we get back, jobs become available. But I guess it's more of a comment now is seeing all of the other things that are so much more long-term, like we're food insecurity, housing, the impacts of low-income workers. You know, they're the people, I mean, we've said it all along, but your data really showed the people least able to weather this storm are the ones hardest hit. So even when we reopen and we have these jobs, we still have our work cut out for us as a state to make sure people have childcare, to make sure, I mean, it sounds like it's almost a cliche now, but your data really showed that the easiest thing to do in a lot of ways is the job part that opens up. The harder work we have in front of us to support our workers is all of these other things that we have shown are so intertwined. And so I was going to ask that question, but your slides kind of gradually went into a place of showing what are the long term and what are the things that will easily open up. And I think that slide was really eye opening, that people can get back into their jobs, but they're going to be perhaps some of the lowest wage workers getting back into their jobs, or people maybe, you know, the impacts on the BIPOC community of women. And so it's more of a comment that, you know, this committee's responsibility around the jobs portion, but really we need to do so much as a whole legislative body to take care of our workforce and moving into the future.
Well stated, Representative Olson. The next person in line is Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Barr, I have a question about the slide, and I think it was about the generations in our workforce. And I think you said sort of the wages, how they compare to wages in the past and how that's impacting sort of differential wage growth. And I just caught, like, you had a sentence or two about sort of coming into the workforce and being lower wage jobs, but it'd be helpful to hear from you. And I just wanted to dig in a little bit to, as we move forward and as generations, as the baby boomers fully retire, are we actually seeing a differential wage growth in different populations? Is it impacting who holds the wealth and what percentage of the populations do?
Dr. Barr?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenman and members, I can say, so that comment was just meant to say that at later career stages, people on average make more than in earlier career stages. We did see growth in wages and growth in employment, and growth generally in a number of different indicators that would suggest that there was movement into higher wage jobs for all communities in Minnesota up through 2019. So we did see that. We did see that for some of the lowest wage workers as well, that we did see some of that growth. Whether that will continue afterwards, I think is another question. But up until 2019, we did see some of that. I'm not sure if Dr. Kolumbakidis is still on, if she wants to add anything to that in terms of the aggregate or what that means in the aggregate or otherwise.
Dr. Kolumbakidis?
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you, Dr. Kolumbakidis.
Okay. Can you repeat the part of the question that you thought I would be able to respond to.
Dr. Brough?
So, so as I understood it, the question was, can we say anything about wage growth as baby boomers have retired to the rest of the community, to the rest of the kind of people who are left back in the workforce? And I said, as of 2019, we had seen wage growth, we had seen more employment, and especially among workers of color, we had seen that growth up and through the 2019 data. I didn't know if there was anything else that you would add to either what that means in the aggregate or for some of the lowest skill workers.
Yeah. Mr. Chair.
Continue, Dr. Columbakidis.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members, so if you're to overall employment income, the wage and salary income chart that I showed you has continued to grow. And grew through 2019. We'll see a decline for 20, and then we expect growth going forward. We have growth going forward at a pretty robust, pretty moderate rate going forward. Because of the tightness in labor supply that Dr. Brower talked about, more of the growth going forward is because of in our forecast, is because of growth in wages per worker. So there are a couple of conflicting things going on. As baby boomers retire, they tend to have a lot of seniority in jobs, and they retire with a pretty high salary. And then you bring someone in to replace them that's at a relatively lower salary, and so that can dampen wage growth per worker. But at the same time, the restrictions on labor supply from slow labor force growth means that the people who are working can command a higher wage. I don't have information on what has happened in that regard, but going forward, our expectation is that a larger share of wage growth is going to be in growth in wages per worker. And we don't do that forecast distributed across different wage levels.
Representative Greenman?
I really appreciate that. And thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just had, this may be just more for the longer term. I think what I'm trying to square is the changes in sort of demographics of our workforce, along with sort of the diversification we talked about, and then the slides talking about the most vulnerable workers, the lowest wage workers, particularly thinking about our BIPOC communities, and as we move forward, how those trends, if we don't get a handle on our disparities, how those trends are actually going to impact overall wage growth amongst different workers and also wealth amongst different workers. So I think maybe a longer term trend question, but I'm interested in sort of how all of these data pieces fit together as we move forward. So I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Dr. Brower, have we seen a net increase or decrease in the number of people moving into the state? And how has that impacted our state's budget?
Dr. Brower?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hamilton, what we have seen in the last year was almost no net gain or loss due to migration. So what we had seen in the prior 2 years was a bit of an increase in migration, that we gained more people than we lost. For 2017 and 2018, the 2019, which is the most recent data point, showed that we gained only 63 people. So those gains that we thought, that was an estimate. we can't go name those people individually. The gains have been very, very small in the last year is the estimate. We'll know more about, we'll have more precision around that once the 2020 census data are released, about just how many people moved away from Minnesota and how many people moved here in the last decade.
Thank you. And Mr. Chairman, one more question for Dr. Columbakidis.
Go ahead, Representative Hammond.
Thank you, Ms. Chairman. Dr. Columbakidis, the district that I serve borders Iowa, and our Senate district borders Iowa and South Dakota. And I'm wondering, how does the Minnesota's economic outlook compare to our neighboring states who have taken a different approach as it pertains to business closures? Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair, Representative, trying to think of the most recent data on unemployment rates by state. Minnesota is seventh lowest among states with regard to the unemployment rate, and I think that our nearest neighbors are in that same category with lower unemployment than nationally. But I can't say at the moment how we precisely compare to each of them. Our economies are very different. So while there are good reasons to compare us to our neighbors in terms of people moving in and out of those states, the economy of Minnesota is much more diverse than Iowa or South Dakota or North Dakota. And we have a much larger metropolitan area. We have a larger number, much larger number of corporate headquarters. So in terms of our economic outlook, our outlook is very different from theirs. Our income is higher, all of those kinds of things. But in terms of just unemployment, we're all in the same, about in the same bucket at the moment.
Mr. Chairman, and Dr. Kolumbakidis, you know, I understand that argument. However, southwestern Minnesota is a lot different than Minneapolis-St. Paul.
Sure.
And we would reflect more on our neighbors to the south and to the west when it comes to comparing the economic jobs available, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's been a lot of criticism from the business owners in our area. They've had to close when people could jump in their car and drive 15 minutes to the south and spend their money in a similar business down there, or do the same thing and run, you know, just a few miles to the west into South Dakota. And so I understand when you're saying Minnesota as a whole, the demographics are different. However, if you break it down geographically, the district that I serve looks a lot more like South Dakota and Iowa than it does Minneapolis-St. Paul. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Dr. Kolumbakidis, if you wanted to respond.
Sure, that point, Mr. Chair, Representative, members of the committee, that point is well taken. And so one might want to look at unemployment rates, you know, by county to make those comparisons rather than simply by state. But I did look up the unemployment rates by state, and Minnesota's, as I said, was seventh. South Dakota is third, Iowa's fourth, North Dakota is 11th. So we are, with our neighbors, we're all at state level. I understand your point about regions, but regarding the state, we're kind of all in the same category.
Thank you. The next person is Representative Juggins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I believe this is probably a question for Susan Brower, and it piggybacks a little bit on Representative Hamilton's question. With the population shift, do we have specific numbers as far as the age groups of the migrations? In other words, are there more younger individuals and families moving into Minnesota? And are we seeing more of a migration out with baby boomers, for example?
Dr. Barr.
Mr. Chair, Representative, migration tends to be a phenomenon and has been a phenomenon of the young. It's young people who migrate. By and large, almost all of the migration that happens is happening by people who are 18, 19, 20 years old. It does happen in the middle years of working years as well. It does happen by older adults, but most of the migration trends from any given year are being driven by young people in their early 20s, and much of that is related to post-secondary school, moves for post-secondary school. In terms of migration of baby boomers out of the state or into the state, we do see a small net outflow of baby boomers, very small relative to the migration that's happening for younger folks, but it is there. We do see a very small outflow of baby boomers reaching retirement age, right around the age of mid-50s to early 60s. We see that. But we also see a net inflow of folks. We tend to, year over year, to see a net inflow of folks in their later years, in late 70s to early 80s. It's kind of this picture of a lot of movement around the time of your early 20s, people settling once they have families and school districts and mortgage payments, and then more movement again right around retirement, late retirement movement back to the U.S. or to Minnesota.
Okay, follow up, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
So you mentioned with the migration or the inflow, one of the factors is the quality of our schools and education. So young families might be wanting to move into Minnesota to take advantage of that. Do you also track some of the reasons why the older Minnesotans might migrate out of the state?
Dr. Barr.
Mr. Chair, the data that I look at doesn't specifically ask that question, why did you move? And so when we're making guesses about why people moved, we're mainly looking at the time in their life that they're moving. And just based on our knowledge of what goes along with that time of life. So no, we don't have any specific data that would say why they moved, it was for, you know, the big reasons that people usually raise are whether it's for warmer weather, whether it's to be closer to family, whether it's for tax reasons. All those kind of are lumped into one big group of movers, and we can't differentiate one from the other.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Brower. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you so much. Just have got a quick few questions. I know the immigration system that had changed, we saw lots of gains when the immigration system was more favorable, you know, individuals coming in, increasing the number of workers based on the individuals coming through immigration, whether it's direct or secondary migration. Do you anticipate that will be changing given that there's a new federal administration which is more favorable, understanding the needs of migration to the United States?
Mr. Chair, members, we did see impacts of federal policy on flows of migrants to Minnesota in recent years. We saw that in terms of the flow of refugees to Minnesota, primary refugee settlements. We also saw that in terms of a broader group of migrants, more that may have come here for jobs, may have come here for school. And what we heard on the ground was much of that group, not the refugees, but the other group, was due to a slowdown in the processing of visas rather than a cap that changed the number of visas overall. And so I guess it depends on the policies that are enacted, the federal policies that are enacted going forward, whether we'll see those return. We know up until 2019 that employers were hurting for workers in Minnesota. And so the demand, at least up until that time, was certainly there for workers from anywhere. And so I would expect that if policies change and that the demand returns, that we would see some of that economic migration as well.
The other question I wanted to ask you, Dr. Brower, is we had seen a significant inequality when it comes to median income and the number of children who may end up living in poverty, which were covered during this conversation. Can you specify how COVID-19 will significantly even impact communities, low income and BIPOC communities, when it comes to wealth inequality, the wage that we have seen, and how the recovery will look like in the future?
Mr. Chair and members, in terms of long-term consequences, I mean, I guess the picture that I have in my mind right now is Dr. Kolumbakidis's graph that shows that I think it was for higher wage, was it wage or education, where there's already been a full recovery in terms
income.
Of
yeah.
I'll let you speak to it. So I would just say that would serve to increase inequality if what we're seeing is that higher wage workers are already back and have seen less loss and are already recovered and that growth is already happening. I would expect that potentially could increase wage inequality if we're not seeing the lower wage or lower skill workers moving up through to higher order skills and wages.
Thank you so much, Dr. Brower. One quick question for Dr. Kolumbakidis is we've heard about K-shaped recovery, mm-hmm. and I just wanted to know which industry was insulated based on what we know that the COVID-19 did not have much of an impact. And we know that those who are at the lowest end, as we're talking about, may not have seen significant, we know that they're receiving unemployment or other benefits, which is not up to par to what they've been receiving compared to the top wage earners or income earners who are thriving. Can you speak a little bit about that?
Sure. Sure, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. So the K-shaped recovery, as you may know, is about what we've been talking about, the unevenness of the recovery, and that there are some jobs and some sectors of the economy that are growing and others that are not, that have not recovered. And we've looked at that by industry, we've looked at it by occupation, we've looked at it by race and ethnicity, meaning we in this committee today, and by wages. So what occupations or sectors have been insulated or sort of on the top part of that K? A couple of points. One that it relates to what Dr. Brower said about telecommuting is that any job where you can continue to do your job from home via telework has been relatively insulated, not in the sense of our jobs haven't changed, all of our jobs have changed, but in that that's where the job retention has been and where employment income retention has been. And Minnesota having a large share of our population doing a work in the professional and business service area, that sector is relatively insulated. So that has been beneficial to the state as a whole. So the opposite of that is that anything that has to be face-to-face, any of those frontline jobs, those are the ones that that have been more affected by government restrictions and by safety concerns. And then another sector that another change that has happened that has protected a sector is this shift in consumer spending from services towards durable goods. And so the businesses that are producing those goods, to the extent that they can find the workers to get the stuff made and can overcome logistical challenges, those industries have done well as well.
Thank you so much, Dr. Kolumbakidis and Dr. Brower, for your presentation today, for your helpful insights. We really appreciate the work that you do for all of us and for the state of Minnesota. Having said that, the time has come for us to adjourn the meeting. I don't have any other business. I just want to say thank you all, and the meeting is adjourned. Thank you so much.